Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, joined by John, as always. How you doing, buddy?
Dude, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing much better than recent weeks. Really, I guess just time heals things, and I don't know. Spring is springing. Baseball is baseballing. John Cena turned heel. We got a lot going on.
Yeah, we could talk a whole episode about the John Cena turning heel thing. Who saw that coming?
Not me.
Yeah, because you can't see him. But nobody saw that coming. But we have a case for you today. I mean, we're looking at all of our research notes, and it's like double the typical research notes. So,
and I mean,
be good.
The rabbit holes we could go down, we'll chase some rabbits, but there are a lot more to chase that we're gonna leave for now. We don't normally cover cases that are ongoing. We try to wait till there's finality in a case to tell the complete story. But this one just keeps dragging on, and I feel like we need to at least start telling the story. Then we can revisit it when we have more clarity. But before we get started, I want to thank a couple folks who submitted 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. This comes from A Person in a Large World. What an insightful name.
I'm a large person in a regular world.
I'm a 14-year-old, and I absolutely love True Crime Cast. I listen on long car rides with my family. My favorite episode so far was the Watts family episode. That's a dark episode.
Wow.
14-year-old. We appreciate you listening. Hope your parents approve.
Yeah, this one check with your parents before listening to any more.
Yeah. I assume it's a girl, just because most of our listeners are women, but it could be a guy.
My son listens sometimes, so it could be him.
Could be.
But he's not 14 anymore.
This one comes from Dame Dana. These guys genuinely care, and it shows. It makes for amazing listening.
Thank you. Say it again.
Dame Dana.
Thank you, Dame Dana.
We really do care.
Yeah.
Like, for real.
Awesome. I want to say thank you to Official Flit. Jamie, is that how you would say that over on Patreon?
Yeah, Official Flit, Fly T.
Official Fly T, Official Flit. Help me pronunciate that by sending us a message in Patreon. Thank you so much for joining. Officially joined the $3 a month level, so thank you so much.
Never a bad idea to send us a phonetic pronunciation when you sign up for something.
Man, this
Never
month we dropped the bonus episode of Joseph Nasso. Nasso?
Yep. Nasso. Yeah.
And it is insane. He is the original alphabet killer, if you take away Agatha Christie. And because she never actually murdered anyone that we know of. She wrote about it. But this guy kind of followed in her footsteps, but like literally killing people with double initials. So that is a fascinating case. It's only available on Patreon. So go check it out.
Absolutely. In today's case, like I said, this is a current one. We're going to talk about the Idaho 4, give our take on the story, what we think is going on here, and I mean, we're recording this on the Friday before its release. There was breaking news last night we'll get to. Like, this is just happening so rapidly, and it's so frustrating to so many people, so we want to put it all in one place so you can get caught up.
Oftentimes we'll do, like, any updates we'll cover on Patreon, so another reason to go check that out.
Absolutely.
All right, get us rolling, man.
All right. Typically, we'll start a story by telling you the people involved, maybe play a 911 call, start to talk about a scene discovered by some innocent bystander. But most of this isn't clear. The text from the 911 call just came out yesterday. We don't have the audio of that yet. But there has been an arrest. Court proceedings, however, have been hard to come by. Both the prosecution and defense are sealing everything, which is frustrating the judge. Everything's heavily redacted. The judge has had to put a non-dissemination order in place, making sure everything stays where it's supposed to be and doesn't leak to potentially influence jurors. He ordered people connected to the case and not about it at all outside the court. Again, that's to ensure there's a fair trial, but it leaves us with a lot of questions, and we really just get what's leaked. Like I said, we got texts between some roommates last night and the 911 call. So what do we know here, John?
So it was the fall semester of 2022, so really just a few years ago, and there were five female students who were living in an off-campus home together. They were going to the University of Idaho, which is located in Moscow, Idaho. When you look at it, it looks like a Russian city, Moscow, but apparently it's not pronounced as Moscow.
Well, we have a Versailles in Kentucky that some people would pronounce as Versailles and probably get laughed off their horse, but
fair enough,
because there are horses there.
So this house they lived in was a big house. It was actually three stories, had six bedrooms. There were two bedrooms on each floor. An early morning of November 13th, 2022, four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death in that home. Now, this was the first murder in Moscow since 2015. There was one victim, Zaina Kernodal. Kernodal?
Yeah.
What is it?
Both sound good to me.
And she was from Post Falls, Idaho. She was a member of the Pi Beta Phi sorority, and was in her junior year studying marketing. Her sorority sister said Zaina was entirely herself all the time. A beautiful aurora, I can't say that.
Aura
followed her everywhere. And Zaina was one of those people who you could not possibly be sad around. I love that kind of person. And apparently Zaina was that.
Challenge accepted. I can be sad around anybody. You know that.
Yeah, fair enough. Zaina lived in the home, and she was just 20 years old that night.
Another victim in that crime was Zaina's boyfriend, Ethan Chapin. Ethan was raised in Conway, Washington, and worked on a tulip farm. He was one of a set of triplets who all went to the University of Idaho. Ethan was a member of Sigma Chi fraternity, and his fraternity brother would say that he was the life of the party. Always optimistic, always looking for excitement. The type of person that picks you up when you're down to keep you on a high when you're out. When he talked about Ethan and Zaina, he said their energy is unmatched. Both were always just the brightest lights in the room. Ethan was a freshman studying recreation, sport, and tourism management. He didn't live in the home, but he was there staying with his girlfriend the night of the murder. He was there a lot. He was 20 years old at the time of the crime.
Another victim from that house was Kaylee Gonsalves, who grew up in Rethdrum, Idaho. She graduated from Lake City High School and was getting a degree in general studies at the University of Idaho. She was a member of the Alpha Phi sorority. The president of her sorority would say this about her. She said that Kaylee had a contagious laugh. She laughed often at herself and with others. Just seemed like a very bubbly, happy person. Kaylee lived in that house at one time, but she had graduated early and had moved out recently. So she was back visiting for a party and to also visit her best friend, Madison Mogan. Kaylee was just 21 years old at the time she was murdered.
And then there's her friend, Madison Mogan, who grew up in Coraline, Idaho. Her friends and family called her Maddie. She had also graduated from Lake City High School and was studying marketing at the University of Idaho. Of Maddie, one of her friends said that she was a great person. She had a bright smile. She had a bright future. She was bright in every way that a person could be. Maddie was the kind of person that made sure everyone felt welcomed and cared for. She was also a member of the Pi Beta Phi sorority and worked at a restaurant downtown Moscow with Zaina. So all these connections, obviously some people are living here at the time, some are kind of visiting, so it's a college town. There's always a lot going on, and Maddie and Kaylee were the best of friends. They had met in sixth grade and were inseparable from that day on. At the vigil after these murders, Kaylee's dad noted that the girls were together until the very end, that they, quote, died together in the same room, in the same bed. Maddie still lived at home, and she was just 21 years old the night of the murder.
So these four were stabbed to death on the second and third floors of the home while they were in bed. and they were not gagged or restrained in any way. I mean, so Jamie, am I wrong? It just appears as if all four of them were in bed and stabbed to death while they were in bed.
They were attacked, appear to be attacked in their sleep, but we'll find out. There was some motion in the home and, you know, the how this happened in a house without alerting everybody else is one of the major questions.
But at first glance, it just looks like someone or someones were able to like stealthily move through the house and stab people while they were asleep is how it looked.
Yeah.
Not saying that's what happened, but that's how it appeared.
Right. Or multiple attackers in different rooms. That way you're not getting the alert and response.
So again, they were not gagged. They were not restrained. There was apparently so much blood at the scene that it was actually dripping on the outside of the house. I mean, this is just, think of a horrific scene and multiply it by 10, it sounds like. There were two other female roommates in the home who were sleeping on the first floor, and they were unharmed. Maddie and Kaylee were in Maddie's room, while Zaina and Ethan were in Zaina's room. All four of the victims were pronounced dead 13th, 2022. I remember the news all being a buzz about this around that time. I mean, this is like, I mean, it was in the thick of COVID, I guess. COVID might have been winding down a little bit, but this was like definitely taking over the news waves. Detectives determined the time of killing was likely between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m. So a pretty precise time that the detectives give. They also found Kaylee's dog alive and unharmed on the third floor.
And our writer, McKenzie, gives a note here that it was really hard to find news about this dog as part of the story, but she was glad that the dog was finally found okay. And it has been brought up that the dog was present, which is another question of if there's a dog present, did the dog interact with the killer? Let's rewind to earlier that day and what led up to this tragedy. On the evening of November 12th, Ethan and Zaina were at a party at the on-campus Sigma Chi fraternity house, and they came back to the house at 1:45 a.m. Kaylee and Maddie had gone to the Corner Club, which is a sports bar in downtown Moscow, around 10 p.m. They left the club around 1:30. Footage from a Twitch live stream shows the girls at a local food truck at an area called Friendship Square. This video showed the girls at 1:41 a.m. chatting and smiling, getting some food, and then 10 minutes later, you see them leaving, getting a ride home with someone they allegedly knew and trusted. That person has been cleared by investigators, and their name has not been released officially. I'm sure you can find it online. They got home around 1:56 a.m. The two other roommates were also out in Moscow that night, and they were allegedly home by 1 a.m. So we see all six people staying in the home that night arrive between 1 and 2 in the morning.
According to the other roommates, Kaylee, Madison, and the couple were home by 2 a.m. Kaylee's phone showed that she called her former longtime boyfriend 7 times between 2:26 and 2:52 a.m., Madison's phone also showed 3 calls to the same guy from 2:44 a.m. until 2:52 a.m. So this ex-boyfriend did not pick up any of these calls, and investigators questioned him and cleared him pretty quickly. So we don't anticipate him being involved in this. This is what happens, you know? I mean, right. If you I'm going to assume the girls were drinking a little bit. Is that a safe assumption?
I believe so.
So if you have some stuff on your mind and you are drinking, you make calls to people.
Yep.
And that's kind of where my head went.
Same for me. And that's 11 calls to the same guy. I'm assuming he either has these numbers blocked or has his phone on silent from him.
Yeah. It's late, man. I'm too old to be doing this, but also, a DoorDash for Zaina was delivered to the house around 4 a.m. So that's really close to the time in question here. Zaina's phone also showed that she was on TikTok at 4:12 a.m. At approximately 4:17 a.m., a security camera less than 50 feet from Zaina's room picked up the sounds of a dog barking and distorted audio of what sounded like voices or a whimper followed by a loud thud.
So we had narrowed the time of the attack between 4 and 4:25. And at least for Zaina, The attack in her room seemed to have not taken place before that time of 4:12. One of the surviving roommates said that she woke up at around 4 from what she thought was Kaylee playing with her dog because she heard the dog running around. The roommate said a short time after that, she heard someone she thought was Kaylee say something to the effect of, "There's someone here." The roommate said a short time after that, she heard someone she thought was Kaylee say something to the effect of, "There's someone here." She looked out of her bedroom and didn't see anything when she heard the comment about somebody being in the house. Then she opened her door again when she thought she heard crying coming from Zaina's bedroom.
Yeah, at that point she heard a male voice and said something to the effect of, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." And according to an affidavit released later, the roommate said when she heard the crying, she opened the door and saw a man in black clothes and black mask walking past her. And then she was just standing there frozen in shock. The roommate didn't recognize the man. She described him as a 5 foot tall, 5'10" tall man, maybe taller, who was not very muscular, but athletically built. And he had bushy eyebrows. She said that he walked toward the sliding glass door as she closed her door.
These stories change, and you and I were talking recently about a situation that happened in my life, and I just couldn't recall certain details about what happened. Eyewitness testimony is tough.
Even though what you experienced was, like, very alarming, and you should remember the details. It happened in your face, but the details are iffy, and I think it's just almost like a trauma response. Your body and brain are just going wild.
And, you know, this roommate, her story would change. Some people put a lot of pressure on her, saying she either knew what was happening and didn't do anything, or maybe even had a role in it. But I just, let's put pause on her for a little bit. Then we get to the morning of November 13th, and the two surviving roommates called friends over to their house because they thought one of them passed out and was not waking up. At 11:58 a.m., someone using one of the roommates' phones, authorities haven't disclosed who actually made this call, and the 911 call, the text from it, has just been released. They called 911 requesting help for an unconscious person. Responding officers found the four murdered victims. There was no sign of forced entry. Nothing appeared to be missing from the home. Investigators say they don't believe anybody else was in the home at the time of the 911 call. They don't think the perpetrator was there when they were called. Now, along with the 911 call, John, they released these text messages between the two roommates. One's initials are DM and the other BF. Again, not officially released. You can go find their names if you want to. DM texts, "No one is answering." Second text, "I'm really confused right now. Kaylee, what's going on?" Those last two were obviously to Kaylee. Then BF texts back, "Yeah, dude, WTF. Zaina was wearing all black." DM comes back, "I'm freaking out right now. No, it's like ski mask almost." BF comes back with STFU, "actually." Then DM says, "like he had something over his head and a little his mouth. I'm not kidding. I'm so freaked out." BF says, "so am I." And DM says, "my phone is gonna die." BF says, "come to my room. Run down here." So those are between the roommates. I think DM's obviously the one that we talked about opening her door and seeing the person. And those were just leaked or released or whatever you want to call it on March 5th of this year.
Okay. And then, so go back to that. Who did they say was wearing the mask?
They said that Zaina was wearing all black.
Okay.
And then I believe there were some other, I mean, there had to be some other texts here, because then she goes into, "no, it's like a ski mask almost, like he had something over his head and over his mouth."
So that couldn't be talking about Zaina. So
right,
it's someone else that we don't know the name of. So yeah, wild, just wild. Autopsies were performed on the four students, and they were performed in Spokane, Washington. The coroner stated that all victims had been stabbed multiple times with fatal wounds that had occurred in the chest and upper body. and they were all stabbed with a large knife. So if this was not the same knife that stabbed all the victims, the knives were very similar. At least one victim did have defensive wounds, which made it appear as if they had tried to fight off their attacker. It appears that the victims were attacked while sleeping in their beds. None of the bodies showed signs of sexual assault, and all of these were ruled as a homicide. The murder weapon has never been recovered, but it is believed that the killer or killers used a fixed blade knife. This is, you know, a standard kitchen knife, perhaps. I mean, it's a blade that's not retractable or folding. It's not a pocket knife. It's a larger knife than that. So a hunting knife or a kitchen knife, yeah, something like that.
Very well described. And they knew that it was at least one knife, but if there were two, they were very similar. And I think that just kind of goes back to the question, how many attackers? And we're going to take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about the investigation, how they narrowed in on a suspect, arrested him, and where we stand. In the 24-hour news cycle, people need things to talk about, and this was a big mystery. It was fresh news, and it led to so many people going online, going on TV, and speculating. TikTokers, psychics, social media sleuths have taken this case and speculated wildly, from assigning it to certain serial killers to accusing people that were in the home. So there's been a lot of rumors and misinformation about this case. The Moscow Police Department actually released a statement to the news saying, "There is speculation without factual backing, stoking community fears and spreading false facts. Tracking down rumors and quelling rumors about specific information and specific events that may not have happened is a huge distraction. We are not releasing specific details as we do not want to compromise the investigation." And I totally get that, John. The rumors out there, it makes everybody afraid, because you have to wonder, is there somebody out there killing that's still here? And it takes time away from the true investigation of what we know to be fact. They also warned the public that people harassing or threatening people that were involved could be facing charges, largely as they talked about the other roommates. The Idaho 4 murders are what they were tabbed in the media. And it's no doubt a case study in what happens with cyber sleuths getting involved and where the boundaries are, which is another reason we try to wait till the end of a story before we get in. But for this one, we're close enough, I guess, or there's enough that we need to at least start a one-parter here. The grieving families agreed that they were all disappointed in the lack of transparency in the case, but they continued to support law enforcement. Kaylee's dad, who's been one of the faces of this group, said, "I have to assume and hope that this is all part of their plan and they've got this all figured out. I know that there's some really good, hardworking guys and girls that are on this case that I've met. And they looked me in the eyes and they told me straight out that they're working and they're doing everything in their power."
And I get it. From a parent's perspective or a family member's, you want to know what's going on. You want to be in that loop of people in the know. But as an investigator, you have to hold your cards close to the chest. Anything that you put out there could potentially come back to hurt you when you're trying to investigate the case. So I get from both ends, it sucks all the way around.
Horrible situation.
But this did not mean that the police were not taking tips from the public. On November 19th, 2022, Moscow PD requested for the public to provide any video of the house that was recorded on the night of the killings. There was a phone tip line and there was an email address that were created through the FBI that allowed the public to submit any tips they had. So by December the 5th, 2022, there were 2,600 emails, 2,700 phone calls, and 1,000 digital submissions. By Christmas Eve, there were at least 15,000 tips regarding this case. So the public was allowed to call in, and they did. They submitted a lot of tips. And these tips actually led the police to begin searching through the records of over 22,000 fifth-generation Hyundai Elantras that were manufactured between 2011 and 2013. So this is interesting. There was a camera out in the area of the house that captured a white or light-colored Elantra around the time of these killings. Investigators noticed that this car made multiple passes along the same route near the home. Another surveillance video caught an Elantra passing the victim's house three times, and that started around 3:29 a.m., so just 30 minutes before the window of opportunity started. At 4:04 a.m., the Elantra went back to the home for a fourth time, and at 4:20 a.m., that car was seen speeding away from the victim's neighborhood. This is a pretty critical evidence, if you ask me. I mean, this is, it's at the right time, it is in the right area. I believe they are able to narrow in on this one.
Yeah, and that's such a great lead. This is the kind of lead I think you hope for an investigation like this of, we need to find this vehicle.
Unfortunately, there were a lot of them in the neighborhood.
So many Elantras. On January 5th, 2023, the Idaho State Court released court documents that revealed new details on the investigation, including the other roommate's account of what happened that night. Another piece of information learned from those documents is that there was allegedly DNA found on a knife sheath recovered at the murder scene. If a knife has a sheath, I assume it's more a hunting knife instead of a kitchen knife. Maybe some people carry around their kitchen knives, but that's what I get from that. Now, it should be noted that DNA from three unidentified males was found in the home, including under one of the victim's fingernails. But the DNA from the sheath remains the focus of this case. During the investigation, life at the university had to go on. It's tough, but on the evening after the murders, the university canceled classes for the following day. They scheduled a vigil and had people available to help with counseling and to help people talk through it. The vigil ended up being postponed because of weather, but from day one, investigators told the public that there was no risk to the community, which I think is, scary to say that. How do you know that for a fact if you don't know who did it? So there was a lot of pushback. And 3 days later, the chief said, we cannot say that there is no threat to the community. So they walked back that statement, which I think just further alarmed the community. Others who lived in the area became extremely anxious and cautious, and a number of professors just started canceling classes to help people feel more comfortable, giving online assignments, and just trying to help people feel safe.
Nearly 2 months after the murders, investigators released an affidavit showing the work that they had done to track down their main suspect. So after the bodies were found, authorities zeroed in on that surveillance footage that showed the white Hyundai Elantra. And they traced that specific car throughout the night all the way back to Pullman, Washington. And that was where there was a 28-year-old PhD student living whose name was Brian Kohlberger. And he was a UI student. And he made his commute to UI with a white Hyundai Elantra. Authorities pulled Kohlberger's phone records, and they showed him heading into Moscow right before the attack. Now, his phone was off from the hours of 2:47 a.m. to 4:48 a.m., which would be consistent with Kohlberger attempting to conceal his location during the quadruple homicide, according to the affidavit. When Kohlberger's phone was turned back on, this was at 4:48 a.m., and he was in Blaine, Idaho, which was just south of Moscow. His phone also pinged off a cell tower near the victim's house around 9 a.m. on November 13th, which was approximately 5 hours after the murders. Phone records also showed that his phone was near that house at least 12 times in the 5 months leading up to this murder.
Again, such a solid lead of somebody who's driving a car that you trace to the house, somebody who has their phone off during the time of the murders, and then somebody who stays in that area quite a bit. And as far as authorities knew, there was no reason for him to be in the area. John, this seems like a pretty solid start to an investigation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great lead.
The affidavit also revealed that they had tested the DNA that was found on the knife sheath on Madison's bed. Using a public genealogy database, authorities identified a partial match to someone with a family connection to 28-year-old Brian Koberger. This led investigators to recover trash outside of his home, like they did with the Golden State Killer, but they were all in Pennsylvania at this time, and the DNA found on the trash was from the father of whoever's DNA was on the sheath from the house. At this point, they started monitoring Koberger's outside of his parents' home in Pennsylvania. He was allegedly seen wearing surgical gloves and putting trash in a neighbor's trash can, which obviously looks shady, like you're trying to hide something that can't be traced back to you. Koberger also claimed that he had cleaned his car inside and out and had cleaned it very thoroughly while under police observation. On December 30th of 2022, an FBI SWAT team and the Pennsylvania State Police arrested Brian Koberger at his parents' home. At the time of the arrest, Koberger was allegedly in the kitchen in a shirt and shorts, wearing surgical gloves, and putting trash into separate Ziploc baggies. It's like he knew they were looking for his DNA and trying to get rid of it, but they extradited him back to Idaho. John, what do we know about Brian?
Yeah, he was born on November 21st, 1994, in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania. He graduated from Pleasant Valley High School in 2013 and began classes at Monroe Career and Technical Institute, but he dropped out about a year later. He attended Northampton Community College, where he got his associate's degree in psychology in 2018. And after he got his degree, he worked as a security guard for the Pleasant Valley School District. This was the same school district where his father had been a maintenance worker and his mother was once a substitute teacher. He went on to get his bachelor's and master's degree in criminal justice from DeSales University in Center Valley, Pennsylvania in 2020.
So studying criminal justice and then being accused of a crime, I think it just makes people more suspicious of you, which I kind of get. In the summer before the murders in 2022, he moved to Washington to get his PhD at Washington State University in Pullman. The campus was less than 8 miles west of Moscow, Idaho. In my mind, Washington and Idaho aren't touching, but apparently they are.
I'm glad you said that, because in my mind, I did not realize Idaho was that far west.
Well, apparently it is, at least in part, so we're crime podcasters, not geography podcasters, right? He was doing his first semester as a PhD student studying criminology when the murders happened. He was a teaching assistant at Washington State, and 2 weeks before the murders, faculty members met with Koberger to discuss growing concerns about his behavior, his conduct, his demeanor. They were both worried about him and concerned of some things he may do. He actually got fired from his TA job on December 19th because of his unsatisfactory performance as a TA, including his failure to meet, and this is a quote from the document, norms of professional behavior and interactions with faculty. He was also said to be extremely sexist, being outright rude and cruel to women, including the students that he was teaching. That same semester, Koberger also applied as an intern with the Pullman Police Department. Records provided by the Pullman PD say that they learned Koberger's past education included undergraduate degrees in psychology and cloud-based forensics. These records also showed Koberger wrote an essay when he applied for the internship with the Pullman PD in fall of 2022. Koberger wrote in this essay that he had interest in assisting rural law enforcement agencies with how to better collect and analyze technological data and public safety operations. So he was very familiar with how this stuff is collected, which I think makes his actions in Pennsylvania look even worse.
He was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 felony count of burglary. He was also given a public defender and held without bond and extradited back to Idaho on January 4th, 2023. And that's where he would be held without bail in the county jail in Moscow. The families of the victims say they didn't know this guy at all, but they were happy, relieved, and thankful that there had been an arrest in the case. Koberger was seen in court for the first time on January 5th, 2023, and that was in a court to, or that was where he was going to hear the charges against him. So he appeared to have several cuts on his face, including a 2-inch cut above his chin, on his jawline, and then another one on his cheek. Months later, May 27th, 2023, he was indicted by a grand jury. As the charges were read to him after the indictment, he was asked how he wished to plead for each case, and he said nothing. His lawyer was there with him, and she said that her client was, quote, standing silent on the charges. That is not an option, so the judge entered a plea on his behalf of not guilty.
Interesting tactic there. I'm not sure what he was hoping to get from that. In June of 2023, Koberger's attorney submitted a court filing arguing that there's no connection between Mr. Koberger and the victims and that the DNA evidence should not be allowed. They said there's no explanation for the total lack of DNA evidence from the victims themselves on their bodies and their DNA in Koberger's apartment, office, home, or vehicle with the amount of blood that was at the crime scene. They were wanting the charges to be dropped based on this. But that same month, prosecutors not only did not drop the charges, they announced that they would be seeking the death penalty in this case. In August of 2023, Koberger's attorney said that he had an alibi, but they weren't able to pin down his specific location during the murder because he was, quote, driving during the night and early morning hours. They said Mr. Koberger is not claiming to be at a specific location at a specific time. At this time, there's not a specific witness to say precisely where Mr. Koberger was at each moment of the hours. And this, he's essentially saying he's out stargazing and just driving around looking at stars with his phone off, which if you're going to claim that as an alibi, I got some beachfront property here in Kentucky to sell to you. That same month, Judge John Judge, I mean,
that's
legit.
Destiny.
He agreed to delay the trial after Koberger waived his right to a speedy trial. John, recently we've seen some cases, the Crystal Rogers case in particular here in Kentucky, where the victim's family is exercising their right to a speedy trial when the defense is trying to delay it. We didn't see that here, but they did agree to delay it, and the news just keeps pouring in.
So let's catch up to where we are today. On September 9th, 2024, the judge granted the defense's motion for a change of venue. So now the trial is set to happen in Boise, Idaho, with Judge Stephen Hippler presiding. On October 9, 2024, the judge set a start date for jury selection, and that's going to be July 30th, 2025, and the trial will begin on August 11th, 2025. In January of this year, 2025, his defense team has asked the judge to throw out DNA evidence as it all stems from, quote, an unconstitutional genetic investigation process, end quote. They've also argued that the search warrants in the case were tainted by the police and were because of misconduct. Last month, the judge declined to throw out this key evidence, which cleared the way for the trial to begin this summer. The judge has ordered a gag order for everyone involved in the trial, and as of now, no cameras will be allowed in the courtroom.
Which I go back and forth on this for certain cases, but I don't know how I feel in this particular one. I'm certainly nosy and want to know what's happening, but we saw that there was none in the Richard Allen trial for the Delphi murders, so I think we're going to go the route of that being more consistent moving forward. We've still got a lot of questions here. If Koberger did do it, was he acting alone? Would the other identified males from the DNA samples show that he had accomplices or show that he was potentially not even there at the time of the murder? If he did do it, what was his motive? Where is the murder weapon? Was the killer targeting one of the students in particular? Or were they just staking out a house where there are a lot of people? Or was this a random attack? I think if it's Koberger, we know that he had been planning it by visiting the house. Why did they leave the other two roommates unharmed? And why did those roommates wait so long to call police when they're obviously texting each other in the middle of the night, really scared? On February 24th of 2023, the University of Idaho president said that the house where the murders happened was donated to the university. And John, I think this is one of the more wild pieces of this story. 10 months later, the university demolished the house.
Yeah, I hope they were able to collect everything from that house they needed before it was done. I agree with the decision to demolish it and not to rent it out again, but was that adequate time for investigators to get what they needed?
I don't think it is till you have a conviction, in my opinion. Like, just have it. Don't rent it out. Just let it sit. If you want to demolish it later, that's fine. But you're potentially getting rid of evidence. If you find out another element of the case or how somebody got in, you like, there's other stuff to look for here. We have so many questions. So I very much disagreed with the timing of that. A memorial garden for the victims on campus is being planted. Scholarships for three of the victims have been set up by their families. Ethan, Zaina, Madison, and Kaylee all received posthumous degrees at the spring graduation ceremony on May 13th, 2023. Like I said, we had the transcripts from the 911 call come out recently, those texts from the middle of the night. The most recent filing from the Koberger case, John, is that he is saying he would like the death penalty taken off the table because he's autistic.
Okay.
Do you have an immediate reaction to that?
I wondered early on when he was fired from his TA job because of like just inappropriate
lack of social skills. Really?
Yeah. So I wondered, was potentially he on the spectrum? If you're asking me my gut reaction for taking the death penalty off the table, I'm going to cite a very wise man who posted a TikTok video a week or so ago. The spectrum is that it's a spectrum. So where is he on the spectrum? Obviously, pretty high functioning. I mean, he has degrees. Right. He graduated. He was pursuing a PhD, right? So he has the ability to make decisions and to think. So I feel like in my very limited, you know, encounter with him, and I've never met him personally, it seems like he's able to have logical thought. So right. I am okay with the way things are. And what do you think? You have a very unique situation that may...
Was it my TikTok you were referencing?
Yeah.
Oh, dang, man. Yeah. Thanks. That's...
No problem, man.
That's sweet of you. My first reaction was anger. And part of that comes from... They file something absolutely every week to try to get this thrown out. So in my mind, this is an excuse, and I hate that. If it is, even if he is on the spectrum, I don't know. I have an issue with using that in the legal process to get out of something. However, you know my situation. I have a child that's on the spectrum, and talking to her is very different than talking to any of my other kids. So I could see where there is some misunderstanding. So if it's legitimate, I'm fairly, I don't know. I don't really support the death penalty anyway. I'm fine taking it off the table. But if he tries to use it to not get sentenced to life, I have a real problem there.
Yeah. It's hard to, I mean, I don't know. When you are able to make the decisions that lead you down a path of you were able to obtain a college degree, you've had some jobs, maybe not able to hold them very long, but you know, I know several people who are on the spectrum, and this was a decision that he had to have made to go to kill each of these people. It wasn't a simultaneous killing. He killed one person, moved on to the next, and he did that two other times. So I don't know. I'm like you. I'm fine with taking the death penalty off the table because I don't know that I would want someone not on the spectrum to face that consequence.
Right.
But definitely life in prison without the possibility of parole should be on the table and should not be taken away because of this issue.
I completely agree. I don't think we're going to get answers. I just went through a big list of questions, obviously. I don't think we're going to get all those answered. I don't think we're going to find out exactly why two people were left unharmed or what his exact motive was. I mean, I assume it had something to do with attraction to one of the girls, but I don't know that for a fact.
Well, have any of the girls reported that they were being stalked or felt as if they were being stalked?
The only evidence they have of stalking behavior is how often he was in the area of the home.
See, I was thinking that in my research, one of the girls had said that she had been being stalked, but maybe I made that up because I felt like this was a stalkerish behavior.
Maybe I missed that in my research, so you may be right.
My first thought when I was researching this case is that this seemed like an attack that would involve more than one person.
Right.
But now I think the police have their guy. I'm almost not sure now if there is another person.
Right.
But you wonder, you know, how was it that one person was able to go through this house, kill four people when they were all laying in bed, and then not kill two people who were also at the house? I mean, it's in my mind, the only explanation is they were all laying in bed anyway, and then this guy started going through the house and they were terrified.
Yeah.
They were too afraid to scream. They were too afraid to fight back. Obviously some of them fought back in some capacity, but yeah. And I don't know if there was two people. I think this guy just methodically went through and did what he did. It's also interesting to me that there seemed to be no sexual component of this.
Yeah.
So what was his motive?
Right.
Was it anger in some way towards one of them? And I think this is all information that we'll eventually have once this goes through the legal process.
I think it's pretty obvious from his studies that he was very interested in crime, and particular with murderers. So I think a lot of his research may have been him just becoming fascinated with it and wanted to try it himself. And he targeted one of these girls for a specific reason, or maybe multiple girls. But I do hope we find that out. The trial's supposed to start this summer. As far as I know, they're going to leave it in that area. They're not going to do a change of venue, but news is kind of,
I thought they did do it to Boise, Idaho.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know the geography of Idaho. I assume everything's in Boise.
That's the only city I know of in Idaho.
Sorry for all you Idaho Vandals fans out there. It's not personal. It's my ignorance.
What is like Idaho Vandals? What is that? What sport is that?
I mean, I know they have a football team.
Is that so that's the university?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I didn't know what they were.
Yeah.
Potato farmers.
Also, you have Boise State where they have a blue field.
That's pretty, yeah, I remember that.
That's legit. But yeah, this, we'll keep you posted as we can. The judge has tried to lock everything down. All the motions are sealed. And for as much as they've tried to keep information out, there's a lot out there. So we thought we'd share that today. And we will do a follow-up after the trial and keep you posted on updates over on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook, which is where we show, try to update things as well as they come about, as well as YouTube, and putting some stuff over there.
Jamie's doing a great job, especially on TikTok. So make sure that you find us on TikTok and follow that. Yeah, good stuff over there. Thanks, man.
Guys, we really appreciate you listening to us. This is one of our longer episodes, which I enjoy these much more, that we're able to dig in even more. So hopeful to get this case wrapped up maybe by the end of this year and get some justice for these families.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.